Mr. James, Reel 32. About how many of these concerts do you think you had, pre-Salerno?
Quite a number. Quite a number, because my repertoire changes as well with the passing months, weeks and months, you know. And the RKMS, I must say, politely, he was quite a character, very humorous. And he was getting on in life. He later became a lieutenant quartermaster. He left the battalion eventually, sadly, for me anyway, because I lost a good friend, Billy. But I met him after the war, and I did his house in the Thetford.
When did he leave, do you think?
What?
When did he leave the battalion?
We left us, I think it was about Bleed time. We were changes because Gaines took over as RQMS when he was commissioned. He became the RQ. And it was about that time, about Bleed the time, I think. And he was commissioned, and I don't know where he went, as a lieutenant quartermaster. He went somewhere. But I had a good fortune of meeting him, and he was in the old comrade's book in 1947. His entry showed that he lived in Thetford. And when I was a rep in Norwich, I phoned him up, taking the potluck. I looked in the phone book, and I found his name, Colette. He's not a very, not a common name. And I phoned him up and said, God, I'd be very pleased to see you. Can't you come to mind? I said, no, I'm in the castle, lieutenant in Norwich. But I said, I should be passing through Thetford tomorrow. He said, you must call in and see me. And I did. And I was with him for some hours in his lovely new home, which he bought. He retired from his job on Norwich Airport, and working for some big company. And I met his wife, and I met his daughter in Thetford, and we had a chat about old times, especially the bombing of Saint-Germain, because he was on my left, and we emerged together, lucky to be survivors.
Now, you were like making your own entertainment at this time. Did you have any contact with official ENSA or the battalion divisional dance
band? We had some ENSA shows. We had we had our prototype of ENSA shows.
What were they like?
Professional, very, very good. They left a nasty impression with me. There was one female who came on dressed as a Scottish fisherman. And she sang, "By my colour herring, da 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 da, by my colour herring, fresh the road, fry the fourth." And she was marvellous. And, you know, she gave us this rendition of Scottish songs. I remember her particularly. And I often think about her, as a matter of fact, when I whistle. It's in the subconscious, you know. Colour herring. And I've never heard that since I've left the air all those years ago. But it was it's a folk song, I think. Have you ever heard it? No, but anyway, it's well known, apparently it's a Scottish.
So, so what would an ENSA show consist of, a typical ENSA show?
Well, they'd have not very many. They'd have about five or six troopers, and they'd all have their different talents. It was maybe you'd have a male comedian, and you'd have, as I say, a singer like that woman, singing dressed as a Scottish fisherwoman, and everything was wonderful, and everything was accepted, you know, everything was, we loved the ENSA concerts. We didn't have very many, but we had our quota, you know. We went, I guess we might have had about three or four in the whole time we were abroad, I think, but I went particularly ENSA. I couldn't remember the names or the artists, but they were obviously professionals, you know.
Who would look after them when they turned up with the battalion? Who would be given the job of looking after them?
Well, all the officers. The adjutant would be appointed, somebody who belonged there with, entertainment. I'm not sure whether Captain Pond was with us at the time. He was for a certain bar, the president of the Regimental Institutes. These were the chaps who would sort of look after them. Chaps who would have, Captain Pond, I mean, he was a typical chap, if I may say so. He was sort of a very good soldier, if I'm dare to say that. Because he used to say, well, I'd rather do this than face shot and shell, you know. And a little bit effect. But he knew that I was his character, and that was it. I blame his mummy and daddy for the way he was born up, I suppose.
Was he very well spoken then?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Did you have any film shows, any kind of movies? Was there any facilities for that?
I can't remember having had a film show in the 60s, but we did later on with the bass Wallows. At bass we did. We had frequent film shows.
Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that when we get to that.
But not for the battalion.
And on your nights off in Algiers and so on, were the cinemas for people to go to there? Would soldiers go to the pictures? Or?
Cinemas, I think, in Algiers, no, nobody would have patronized those. I suppose if you would have found one there, the film was with French, and very, very few soldiers had a mastery of French. No, they wouldn't go to the cinema in Algiers. There were other entertainments, but not cinemas.
Now, you've been transferred to HQ Company in your CSM.
Yeah.
Can you remember who took over as colour sergeant at D Company and who you had as colour sergeant?
Well, there was still many colour sergeants at the time. There was Deaconess Day, and there was Deaconess Cosby. And I don't know what happened to Deaconess Shaw. He left us somewhere along the way, but I know that they came in on the boat. He was with the battalion, I think B Company at that time, and there was Deaconess Barker of B Company later. So, there were casualties with the CPMSs, But I really can't remember particularly who took over. I remember some of the names, Day and Crosby. Day was killed, Crosby was killed. No, there were two as an example, there were two CPMSs there killed. Secret Day, Secret Crosby.
And what companies were they?
Probably C and D. But they copped it later, after Bleeder.
Now, at Bleeder, we talked a little bit earlier about your training for mountain warfare and that involved route marches. Can you remember what else that training for mountain warfare involved? Were there any special tactics that were being...
No, well, regarding the mountain warfare, I mean, I knew it was going on, and the weather companies are especially engaged in that. But I headquarters company, wasn't really very involved in mountain warfare. It is well known that, we had enough training for mountain warfare, the generals. That was, I'm from Wales and I lived in the mountains of the Brecon Beacons. But my goodness me, the Jebels of North Africa was mountainous enough. The Atlas Mountains, you see, it was similar. So, but don't forget that the people who fought and had the experience of war in the Atlas Mountains had been killed and wounded and we were depleted. And the people who were coming out now had to learn all that and have that experience themselves. So, really speaking, it must have been similar to what we did in Tunisia. There's no bigger mountains in Italy than there are in Tunis, and tell you that the Jebels, And mountains are mountains. And although I lived in Wales and I was brought up in the mountains, I really began, when I was in Italy, to see the mountains there. Mountain, you have to be a special soldier to like mountains. Well, the Italians had the Ibercevigliari, they were specially trained mountain troops. The infantry don't like mountains.
You talked earlier about the fact that you were issued with a Tommy gun at this stage. Was there any other equipment, any new equipment that you can remember? Any changes in
No, I don't think that there was any, apart from the, we learned about the Germans' new Tiger tanks. We heard about them, and we heard about the Churchill tanks.
Well, these lectures that you were given?
Well, it was gossip, really, virtually. We weren't given lessons about it, but because the Royal Tank Regiment, they were a race apart. But we heard about the AP-8s, on the Tiger, on the German Tiger tanks, And they were supposed to be devastating, and they were, Solero.
Did you, in terms of your anti-tank equipment, you embarked for North Africa with the boys' anti-tank rifle. Had that gone by this time?
Well, the boys' anti-tank rifle was absolutely, you know, it really, it wasn't much good.
But did you still have it at this stage? Had it been discarded?
The Piat replaced it. The Piat mortar, the Piat, fired on the shoulder. You know, that became the infantryman's answer. If he had the guts to get on his belly and wait for the tank to come, and wait for it to be in a position where he could sort of hit it sideways or whatever, the Piat was a damn good weapon. And so that really came into its own more and more with the infantry.
And did you have the Piat?
Yes, we had Piats and Piat bombs. That's right.
And how would they be distributed amongst the?
Oh, they had the companies had their trained chaps, and it was special chaps who fired the Piat. It wasn't anybody. They had special training.
Were they volunteers or were they?
Probably, yes.
And did you ever fire the Piat?
No, I fired one. It was a practice.
And when was that?
Oh, a hell of a kick, you know. But we were all brought up with this new Piat mortar, projectile infantry anti-tank.
When did you fire it? Was this during this phase?
I think it was in Tunisia. I only fired one, but it was a projectile infantry anti-tank, and I remember particularly the seeing stocks and stocks and stocks of them, you know. The RSM was in charge of ammunition, you see.
And this was a Glader that was stocks?
In the RSM, all through. He was in charge of all the ammunition.
Now, you moved from Glader to Berserker, according to the battalion
That's
history.
Right.
What do you remember about that?
I remember particularly that we were moving towards the port of embarkation, and it was another long trip back from Bleda, Algiers, back to Gardimel and beyond, because we went straight on via Gardimel to the hills above Bizerta's harbour. Typical Tunisian scrubland. And we didn't know, but we hadn't seen the vast shipping concentration down at the harbour, because we were up the heights. We hadn't had the opportunity or the privilege, as you know, we couldn't wander if we wanted to. We were there at the biggies, up in the scrubland above Bizerta, probably a week before we were due to embark. Well, every night the Germans must have been aware of the concentration of ships, because they came over in very large numbers to bomb Bizerta harbour. We didn't know they could see the ships. We were just told they were bombing Bizerta harbour. And the flak up in the sky was so enormous from the British guns and attack that it rained shrapnel where we were, and we all had to take cover with steel helmets on. Some blokes were hitting shoulders, you know, with falling shrapnel. It went up, but it literally rained metal. And it was a horrible place.
Was the noise? What was the noise like of this?
Sorry?
What was the noise of this barrage?
Well, we were aware. We had up in our we were aware of the boom, the bombing, and also the attack guns bursting on the floor. We had a grand spectacle.
And did people stay awake to watch it, or did it interrupt your sleep, or how did you?
We weren't too badly affected, because after all, we were going to use the flap and shrapnel and all that sort of thing. It was coming down, it wasn't flying with force, it was raining, shrapnel. You'd be very unlucky to be, you know, to get a bit on your body, but sometimes. Yeah.
Did you see any planes get shot down? Was there any?
Sorry?
Did you see any German planes shot down by the barrage?
I can't remember any shot down, but the concentration of America, it must have been America, because this was an American show, Berserker, incidentally, and the Armada as well. A concentration. And of course, we saw it when we went down on that embarkation day. We saw the extent of it. The American buildup, side by side, endless rows of landing craft infantry bobbing up and down. And hospital ship and LST landing ship tanks, great big ships with doors opening at the front, built specially in short time, 2 years, all this stuff was built by America. And at least Churchill gave them Alaska for it, I understand, you know, but this was the American Armada, built by a chap called Kaiser in America. These ships, they were fragile, but they were there in large numbers to carry equipment and troops. And then we saw the rest of the sea was black as well, with all sorts of ships for the invasion. It was absolutely unbelievable. As far as I could see, ships, oh God, hundreds of thousands of them.
And did you... Was there a general awareness that it would be Italy?
Well, from there, Biserta, we were guessing now, the Sicilians, Sicilian campaign being over, knowing there's a short jump from Sicily over to the toe of Italy, Calabria, we put the two together, didn't we? And we knew that they'd be able to land somewhere along the Italian coast. We were hoping it might have been the Pearl, but we went from Biserta eventually to Sicily, and we had a short hop across the water from Biserta.
Oh, we'll get to that, but apparently according to the battalion history, you moved to Biserta and you had a couple of exercises. Can you remember anything about those exercises with the ships?
Well, no, I can't remember anything about the exercises, but I know that there were sort of exercises taking place at Biserta, but I can't remember particularly. What I can remember in Biserta, to be quite frank with you, was I met up with a bloke who was driving us troops about in troop carrying vehicles. And I met up with a chap from a hometown whose mother kept a pub. And his name was Gomer Willis. And he discovered me, quite by accident actually, when we were travelling in convoy up to Biserta. And we were travelling slowly in convoy as a battalion, and I was sitting in the front with my driver. And I suddenly heard this Welsh voice behind shouting, "Anybody up in Wales?" And Gordon was in the back of our truck. He said, "Ah, I was Sergeant Major from Wales. He was a chap, Gordon, wasn't he?" He said, "You're Sergeant Major from Wales. Where's he from, you know?" So Gordon said, "Yes, because I've had a chat with him, you know. He's from a place called Romney." He said, "Romney? Romney? That's where I'm from." He said, "What's his name?" So Gordon said, "James. Sergeant Major James Romney. Where is he?" He said, "In the front here. In the front." He said, "That's a..." He goes, and I'm looking at him. He came out, and I could hear all this with a smirk on my face. I didn't know who he was. He came up the side of the road and says, "Good God, I remember you when you were that high." He says, "I know your father very well." I said, "I know. My father spent bloody fortune in your mother's pub." So he said, "That's right. My father lived in the Farmer's Arms, down near the brewery. The first pub next to the brewery. Very popular pub. Almost full of people." He said, "Good God, I can't believe it. But I know your father very well." I said, "Yeah." I said, "And I know you, my side farmer, as well." I said, "You know, you're about 10 years older than me or more." So he then was aware of me. And so he sought me out at Biserta and came to find me with a bottle of whiskey in his hand. And he knew that we were going into battle. And he says, "We will have a bloody good drink in this little bivvy here, he said quietly. This is a talk about old times. And he said, I should be watching your fortunes, you know. And he wrote to his mother. And his mother went up to my mother. And, you know, and they were both a couple of Welsh mumps, crying their eyes out about their sons out in North Africa and Italy. I learned all about it after the war.
And you mentioned off the tape Captain Pritchard being a Welshman, and you had a good relationship with him.
He as well. He had joined the battalion. Why? But of course, I became wary of mostly in overseas, and he became the adjutant. And he was a very nice chap. He was an adjutant who went from company to company to talk to the our majors and to the company commanders, and you know, as adjutants do, keep in touch. And he offered a chat with me about the company, the land of our birth. And so, you know, we're fellow Welshmen. And he was a very popular chap and friendly, but not because he was Welshman, but he was friendly. So at Blida, I took his photograph with that German camera. And not knowing what was going to come out, it was only a cheap old film anyway, like quite an Algiers somewhere, and he took my photograph with a cook sergeant and colour sergeant Crosby, and you've got to copy that photograph.
Now, you were at Bizerta. You can't remember the preparations for the learners. Were there any lectures or any orientation?
No, we were not supposed to know where we were going. Now, I couldn't believe it. Fancy trying to keep that a secret. And we were not told where we were going. It was all conjecture. But we put two and two together that it would be Italy and well up the lake. Because I'm not sure at that time whether Monty and his army in Sicily had actually crossed the Straits of Messina to go to the toe of Italy, Calabria. I'm not sure whether they had taken that, whether they had yet sort of crossed over there, but of course that was the next step to Monte, and the Americans as well. But all I knew was that we were going to be part of the American Fifth Army. We saw stars and stripes flying from all the ships that were called Old Glories, and there were the American flags in very large numbers. Somebody said that we were going to be under command of General Mark Clark, and that we were not going to fight as British soldiers. We were going to fight as part of the American Fifth Army. And we were to obey their orders, and we were under them for military discipline and law as well. And it would be, as somebody said, that they tried to get us at one time to wear stars and stripes flashes on our shoulders, and we refused to do it. And so they decided, I understand, that there were to be two British divisions. The 46th Division, to be under the command of General Mark Clark, and the 56th Division. The 46th Division was the oak tree. The 56th Division was a black cat on a red background as a shoulder flash. And a lot of them were the Queen's Regiment. The Queen's Regiment. And I think Hampshire's not one. Anyway, yes, the 1-2-8 Brigade is part of the 46th Division as well. But anyway, there were two divisions, 46 and 56, and at least remember, 46 and 56. And the 56th Division, I understand, were going to fight on our right, and we were both going to be under the command of the Yanks.
Did you have any contact with the Americans as a battalion?
Only at Bizerta, where we actually were down in the harbouring area as a battalion, formed up in companies, waiting to embark. And it seemed an endless age because we wondered what the hell is the hold up. There were all these bobbing LCIs, a long, long line of them, and we wondered when we're going to start. So we started to say, why are we waiting? Why are we waiting? Oh, why are we waiting? Oh, why? And all the youngs were laughing because they'd never heard this bloody song before. And all the troops, it rose in a crescendo. And they were laughingly egged off, these Yankee soldiers, sailors, on the NCIs. And eventually, they could see we were impatient. And at that moment, an officer who should be nameless, I can't possibly name him, came up to me and he said, "Sergeant Major," he said, "I want to confide in you," he said, "I've been given sealed orders, and I've lost them." I said, "You've lost the sealed orders, sir?" I said, "You get shot at dawn." I says, "And you don't know his enemy service?" "No." He says, "I've been to a meeting, I was given my sealed orders not to be opened until ordered at sea, and they're missing." He said, "I've been warned. What should I do?" I said, "You're asking me what you'll do," I said. "I said, you're supposed to be at Sandhurst." I said, "The best thing you can do," I said, "I just found out there's an American here, that each one of these landing craft infantry has got 183 beds, bunks, fold down tubular steel bunks with canvas wood on." I said, "183. I said, "That's two companies." I said, "You better make sure that you know the company commander or the other company going to share the LCR with us and confide in him." He said, "Brilliant idea, Sergeant Major, I'll do that." I said, "And you'd better make sure that he's got his sealed orders and confide him. Tell him now. Go find him now." I said, "We'll be embarking in a minute." And he disappeared and ran off, and he came back and he said, "I know, I just arranged," he said, "we can have LCI number so and so for our company. We should be sharing it with another company." So I've forgotten about conveniently, and that's what happened. He lost his sealed orders. I've always had sleepless nights since then, wondering whether a German spy, knowing about this officer's apparent sort of lack of responsibility, snaffled the sealed orders and conveyed them to the enemy. I often wonder, I often have sleepless nights about it, years and years after, because when you landed in Salerno, the Hampshires, in error, on another LCI, landed in error where we should have done, and they were mown down to a man, and we faced, when we landed, we saw 183 dead soldiers face down. Could have been us. The enemy had planted mines in there before, and they had crossfire. They had Tiger tanks in situation, firing the AVAs, and they had fixed crossfire in the curtain of fire and mine breaches, and the Hampshires suffered. It could have been us.
So you had this problem with sealed orders and so on, but can you describe how you embarked? Yes. The LCI, and what your reaction to...
Eventually, we got the orders that we were going to embark on that LCI there. And all the Yankee battlers were there, and giving us a smile and encouragement, and we saw the American commander up at his conning tower. The landing craft infantry was a flat-bottom boat with an empty belly and diesel engines. And two entrances into the bowels of the boat, the steep wooden, strong steps going down to the bowels from the deck. And there was the conning tower, and the upper part was for the officers. And it was a simple thing. And it housed. It consumed 183 soldiers down there. And there were two hatches where the strong wooden steps were going up to the left and to the right. You know. The soldier, they realized the problem was going to be that these strong wooden steps from where we were, our deck down there, up to the top. Must have been 10 or 12 feet up. And the soldiers were going to have a hell of a lot of trouble to get up there with his full kit on and his rifle in one hand, because he needed some help. So I questioned this, and I said, we've got to drill. And I was ordered, I was detailed,